Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Before we get started today with a special roundtable episode in the absence of Joe, we're going to go ahead and give a quick word from our sponsor. Have you ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all of the online chatter of the millions of investors on social media? Well, your wait is over. The Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds. It's now at your fingertips. Make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trading under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities which show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. No surveys, no guessing. Invest in the wisdom of the crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. And now we'll go ahead and get started with our roundtable discussion. And I'm going to throw it over to you, Doug. What's up?
Hey, Miranda. Thanks so much. This is going to be a really great episode. Not only great because Joe Saul-Sehy is not here. No, I'm just kidding. It's always even better when he's here. But today our theme is going to be each of us is going to introduce one really important idea that we've been thinking about or working on recently. And then we'll bring it out to the whole panel and see what we can come up with to really add value both to the people that we work with and our listeners. But before we get started, let's just check in with everyone who's here. Linda P. Jones, how you doing?
Hey, Doug. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. The weather is turning for you now, right?
It's lovely now this time of year. It gets to be beautiful, 80-degree-ish weather. Love it.
Wow. Wow. That is fantastic. And Miranda, how about with you?
Oh, it's cold. It's just cold. I've lit the fire in the fireplace and I'm wearing a sweatshirt to bed because by golly, I'm not turning on the heat until we get to November.
All right. You hold tight and, you know, wear an extra sweater or two.
What about you, Doug? What's happening on your side of the world?
Well, I'll tell you, totally unrelated to investing. My mother is coming out with a new book. It's a children's book about a little bird who flies from New York to Florida. And it's so cute. We just got all the illustrations back from the illustrator. So I'm looking forward to that. But on a more investment-related note, I want to share with you guys what I want to talk about. Then maybe we'll all go around and then we'll start to dive in. I had a really great meeting today, in fact, with a brother and sister who came in because they had both inherited money from their parents in the form of lots and lots of properties, and they were deciding what to do. And for many years, the brother had been involved in managing the family's affairs with the parents, and now it was all kind of falling on him, and he was thinking of selling everything and distributing it. So that's my topic for the day. Linda, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm going to talk about mortgage rates being over 5% and how that might impact the market and some practical advice for people who are buying or selling homes.
And how about you, Miranda?
I've actually been thinking a lot about what happens when you win big in the lottery or Powerball, and does that really work as a retirement strategy? A lot of people I know are saying, oh, well, you know, I'm buying the lottery and let's, you know, this when I make it big. So I thought about talking about that, especially with, as of recording this, there's an $830 million Powerball.
Oh, that is the sexiest topic of them all. So let's talk about that. Just to confirm, did neither of you actually won that $830 million, did you?
No.
No.
Uh-huh. But if you had, Miranda, what are you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you do is you sit on it and talk to a professional. I mean, I had a payout recently from accelerated stock options, and I didn't make any decisions with the money until I'd had a chance to really think through it and talk to a financial professional and get some ideas on what to do with it. You know, because you look at it and there's a statistic out there about lottery winners who go bankrupt after winning the lottery. And you would think, wow, geez, I mean, if you have that much money, how could you ever go bankrupt? The reality is there's a good chance that you will. In fact, if you're not disciplined, you're going to go broke. And it looks like 70% of lottery winners end up bankrupt. So,
what do you suppose it is that makes people change how they're spending? Because obviously they're upping their spending once they get all this money. Why is it that instantly they just change like that?
So lottery winners are more likely to declare bankruptcy within 3 to 5 years than the average American. And winning the lottery doesn't actually make you happier or healthier. And part of that has to do with the fact that you feel like, oh my gosh, I will never be able to spend all this money. I have so much money. I can do whatever I want with it. And you just go ahead and go crazy, right? You don't think about it. You go out, you buy the big car, you buy the big house, you buy all the fancy things. And that money goes by quicker than you might think when you're not investing it, when you're not having it grow for you, when you're not carefully considering what to do with it. And then, of course, if you get it as a huge lump sum, that affects taxes are involved. Taxes are involved. Even if you get the 30-year payout, you still have to manage the taxes and you kind of forget about taxes. A lot of people forget about taxes, no matter what they're doing, whether it's running a business.
We certainly would like to forget about taxes.
Right.
But I just want to note, I think this applies not only to people who win $830 million, but it applies to people at all levels. You know, you can get a $50,000 inheritance and burn through it in a couple of months.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I mean, it feels like a lot more money, right? That a lot of the time we make our financial decisions based on our feelings and how we're feeling at the time. And it feels like a lot more money and it feels like you're never going to run out. And you just make decisions about it without thinking through it. You know, and I actually had people like, oh, well, are you going to buy a new car with your payout? I'm like, why would I buy a new car with, I'm like, my payout's not that big, you guys. and I guess I could buy a new car, but what would be the point? My car works fine and I can invest the money and get a better return.
Well, you'd be guaranteeing a loss in value of buying a new car, right? Because
oh, definitely.
They lose 50% of their value in a few years. So it's a guaranteed way to actually have less money.
Do you only buy used cars, Linda?
I have in the past only bought used cars. Uh-huh. Yes.
Oh, she says in the past.
Two or three.
Now she's buying them new.
No, but 2 or 3 years old, typically low mileage, excellent condition is what I usually recommend people do because there is so much depreciation on the front end. And that is a common thing for people to have a big success, get a huge chunk of money, and then go out and buy a brand new car that is worth half its value in 3 to 5 years. But Miranda's bringing up great points. And partially, it's, I think, lottery winners think about spending and don't think about investing. And so when you just think about spending and all the things you can buy, then yeah, it is a finite amount of money and it can be gone. But when you think about investing, you're actually replenishing the money. So you have an endless supply of money to spend or to continue to invest. And I actually wrote about that in the Wealth Heiress book, but it is the issue is that people think that it's so much money that they can't run out. But Miranda's exactly right. People who've gotten $700 million, over a billion. I've written about a woman who inherited over $1 billion and went bankrupt. So it's not the amount of money. It's the problem is the mindset is to spend it. And when you spend it, you end it. You don't replenish it by investing it. So you have to invest it to renew it.
I think the reason that people may be very good at spending is because that's what we do. Everyone knows how to spend money because we've all done it our whole lives, whereas so many people have never actually invested. So it's just completely an alien concept to them. And getting any amount of money that you didn't work for often seems, just seems like a lot of money that you're quick to spend right away. Miranda, what are some tricks? You started off by saying that the first thing to do when you get some money is just to think. Stop. Don't do anything. Just think. What's the next thing?
Next, I mean, you want to consult a professional, and then the other thing you need to do too, is as you're doing this, is you've got to figure out how you're going to structure this, how much can you put into like a tax deferred retirement account? How much of it is going into a taxable investment account? Do you want to put some of it into a trust? Can you buy some properties? I think, Linda's going to be talking about real estate here coming up. And so, should I put some into properties and get some ideas of how to put that money to work for you so you get a return? And then you also need to structure things to protect yourself. Because one of the things that happens when you get a big windfall is people in your life suddenly want money from you. I was fortunate, like I said, I had this payout and it was decent. It wasn't life-changing, but it was decent. But even so, I had some family members who were like, oh, hey, maybe you should take that money, make a big down payment on the house, and then you can rent it out to your sibling who is struggling right now and they need a bigger place to stay. And maybe you could just rent it out because their credit's shot. They don't have a huge amount of income. And so they've been trying to buy a house or at least afford a bigger place to rent, and I was just like, I'm not sure that is the best use of my money at this time. So then you have that aspect too. You really need to kind of go into protection mode,
right?
Because people are going to be asking you for favors. They're going to ask you for money. They're going to try and guilt you into doing things.
And get objective advice, get advice from someone on the outside. That's why it actually pays to go to a financial advisor or an accountant or lawyer, someone who can be your no man, you know, a person who just says no for you. Right? I always tell clients they can just blame me. You know, when your kids come and say, "Mom, Dad, I need money for a down payment," just say, "Well, you know, Doug Goldstein said, no. And then they've got someone, you know, who's out on the outside. So it's not the parents saying no. It's just that's the way it goes.
Miranda, what about responsibility? The mindset of buying a lottery ticket versus being able to create wealth for yourself.
That's a big issue too, right? I mean, I've actually talked to people who they're not even fully joking. They're like, "Well, no, my retirement plan is the lottery." They buy 3 or 4 lottery tickets a month. You know, they're spending anywhere between $10 and $20 a month on lottery tickets. And overall, that's not a huge deal if you're like, okay, well, I can afford to spend on the lottery ticket and I view it as entertainment, but, you know, I'm doing other things.
Can I just tell you, the wealthy people that I know don't buy lottery tickets. You know, they often call the lottery like a poor man's tax.
Right.
You know, it's just, and I don't know if it's true or not. I haven't seen statistics on it, but just anecdotally in my business. The
odds are so astronomical. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's like 1 in 100 million or something of winning.
Right. Well, that's why I say, you know, if you're going to do it as if it's entertainment and make sure you're doing these other things, right? It's like, I occasionally go to Las Vegas. I end up in Las Vegas once every couple of years and I have money that I gamble. But once that money is gone, I'm done. I mean, I've had my fun. It's been sort of entertaining. Mostly it's not. Mostly it's just disappointing. But a couple times, like, I've won a little bit. So what I do, if I do win, I take half of that and say, okay, I can gamble more with half of it. But the other half of it, I'm going to invest. And so, like, I go in with this plan that it's mostly going to be entertainment. But if I do win something, then I'm going to put half of it aside for the future or for investing or something, and then only gamble away the other half. And so having that plan, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it if you've got everything else planned out, if you're making plans to, as you say, build your own wealth and work on your own wealth.
Yeah, I think it's very optimistic because not everyone has that. So.
Right. And that's the issue, right? Is when you're like, well, this is my plan. And there are people who legitimately think, well, I'm spending $20 a month on lottery tickets. That's an investment because if I do this over time, I'll win. But when you think about it, is you're like, well, that's $20 a month. Get out my old calculator here.
So that's $240 a year.
That's $240 mm-hmm. a year. And if you do that for 30 years, mm-hmm. that's $7,200.
No, that's a huge amount of money that people have to really decide, being that they probably won't get anything out of it in the end anyway.
Right. And so then I look at it and say, okay, so let's look at what you could have. So I have my friend, he has this thing he calls the wealth calculator. It's just a really simple calculator at calculatemywealth.com. I'm not being paid to say it. It's just a friend of mine and he has this thing. And so anyway, it's called the wealth calculator. And so you can say, all right, so what if I did this for 30 years? You put in your thing, how much you have saved. So let's say you start with zero and say, what if you invest $20 per month? So instead of doing a lottery ticket, and if you do that, if you put it into stocks, then you end up with, there's a chance, I mean, of course, looking at historical averages and projections and everything else, you're not guaranteed, but you're looking at $44,791. So instead of spending $7,200, you could actually have this huge gain of almost $45,000. You'd have almost that in your account. And even if you just put it in a savings account for 30 years, you'd still have almost $10,000.
Yeah, or add a zero to that, and it's a much nicer number.
Exactly, right, yeah. So if you have $20 to spend on lottery tickets, but you're not investing or you're not doing anything else, I say, you know, put that money and start investing it. And then as your finances improve, as your habits improve, as your money mindset improves, then you can start putting more and more in, and it'll make a real difference over time.
You, Miranda, I have to say, are really already sounding like a wealth heiress. And it's very exciting because today we have Linda P. Jones, who can actually talk about that, having dozens of 5-star reviews on her new book, You're Already a Wealth Heiress, these great reviews on Amazon. And I think one of the reasons, Linda, is because the idea that Miranda is talking about, which is don't spend it till it ends, but rather invest it and make your money into something that will really take care of you over time, is something I know you touch on a lot in the book. But you had mentioned in the beginning of the show, and maybe we'll sort of switch trajectories now a little bit to talk about this idea of using real estate how can people build that into their own financial plan? Because, you know, for so many people, they think, oh, you know, real estate, I need millions of dollars to do that. What's the trick?
Well, thank you for the compliments on the book. And I just want to say, Miranda was the epitome of the wealth heiress by explaining how you can take control of your future by investing and building your own wealth instead of buying lottery tickets. So thanks for that illustration that you just showed. Yeah, I think real estate is a fantastic way to build wealth. I am all for people owning their own home, not necessarily because I think that real estate prices are going to rise, whether they rise or fall. The thing that people miss with real estate is because it is something that allows you to buy with debt, and because it is the lowest interest rate that we are given on debt. A homeowner's interest rate is the lowest rate that anyone is given on debt. If you look at credit cards or anything, if a second mortgage or a first mortgage are usually the lowest rates because people have a propensity to want to stay in their home and not lose it. So the risk of default is lower. So interest rates tend to be lower. But people will go out, let's say you bought a $300,000 house and you put 20% down. So you put down $60,000 and borrowed $240,000. You are going to be paying that $240,000 debt over 30 years. And yes, you have to pay interest and all of that, although you get some help with tax deductions with the government. But it is actually going to increase your net worth by that $240,000. So you're taking your debt, which is a negative to your net worth, and you're paying it off and getting rid of your debt over 30 years, which is going to be a positive to your net worth. So if your home value goes up from there, that's just icing on the cake, but you're actually doing a forced savings plan. And I think that's what a lot of people miss. So I'm a big fan of real estate. Yes, there are expenses, and yes, you're going to have to pay for new roofs and for gardeners and whatever you need help around the house. But I'm a big believer in real estate. I think for baby boomers, it's been something that has really helped baby boomers' retirement plans because a lot of people didn't save sufficiently or invest sufficiently for retirement. And so a lot of people have used the value of their home and downsizing to supplement their retirement. And that has saved a lot of baby boomers that otherwise would have been short a lot of funds.
Can you touch on the question when you talk about people using their house as an asset to fund their retirement? One of the things we do see certainly marketed a lot to baby boomers is the idea of reverse mortgage. What's your feeling on that?
I'm not a fan of reverse mortgages. I don't really want to go into the whole description of it, but basically you can live in your house, sell it, and receive an income stream for that. And I just don't think that that is a good thing to do for people. I think people should take control of their own asset and not have someone else control it. But, and I also am not saying that the right retirement strategy is to depend on your house value going up. I'm just saying that baby boomers have been fortunate enough that they have benefited if they've owned a home for a long time, that they have been able to downsize and supplement their retirement plan. But that's not the best way to go in terms of like that. That shouldn't be something that you rely on because we don't know what housing prices are going to do in the future. But I would say what's really interesting right now is that mortgage rates have just jumped over 5%. And, you know, they were 4% a year ago, and they were 3.5% in 2016. And now people are starting to wonder if they want to buy a home or not, because that extra interest on a housing price on a $300,000 home is going to make their payment $200 more a month.
Well, what's happened to people who took adjustable rate mortgages 2 years ago?
People who took adjustable rate mortgages are seeing their interest rates go up and being reset to current market rates, depending on what your loan says. But if that's once a year that happens, then they're going to be reset. So they're going to see their rates go up.
Do you think we have to worry about what we saw in 2008 when people had adjustable rate mortgages and then interest rates moved up and they couldn't afford to pay? And then that, of course, made the bank take over the house and have to sell it. And this happened in whole neighborhoods. And then this sort of spiraled out of control as the real estate prices dropped, and it led to many other problems. Are we at a cusp?
Well, it's very interesting. Nobody knows, but I will say that we have started to see California housing prices come down 11% on average. That was through June, so I don't have an updated number what it is right now. And we have also reports in New York State of about the same drop, about 11%. And we have seen home builder stocks really start to decline here. And as we have new highs on the S&P 500, it's very interesting to note that home building stocks have really been falling off a cliff. And that can often be an advanced indicator of declining profits for those home builders. And we know housing starts have declined. So in the new home category, yes, things have slowed. In the resale category, I think what we've seen is a lot of people moved into real estate as a way to generate income because interest rates were so low, they could buy homes and rent them out and get a more generous income stream and rate of return than they could by buying bonds, for example. And so a lot of people bought real estate as kind of a substitute income stream where they might have bought a different financial asset in the past. And as interest rates go higher, it's more costly for real estate investors to buy real estate and get the rate of return that they want to get. So that might slow down the investor market. On the consumer side, it is more expensive, but the interesting thing is because so many investors have bought homes, the rental market is ginormous. And if you look on Zillow.com, which I really like that website to go to and look, and again, not a paid ad, just my preference, you can look at homes for sale versus homes for rent. And there's a lot of homes for rent and not as many homes for sale, but those homes for rent are empty. And they're not being rented. And so if those people decided they wanted to sell, that could dramatically impact the supply of homes for sale. But right now, all those homes are off the market and they're being held for rent. So the inventory is still low on the for sale sign, and that's keeping the prices up a little bit. But people are finding that they're having to cut their prices in order to sell their homes, and they're sitting on the market longer. So we'll see how the supply and demand all balances out.
And how much further up do you think the cost of a mortgage has to go in order to really put a halt or a real dent or actually do a lot of damage to the real estate market?
That's a good question. I really don't know. Robert Shiller, who has created the Case-Shiller Index for housing, let me just read what he said. He said, the economy seems to be coasting upward, but this kind of complacency, this kind of confidence can be volatile. The question is this a turning point in the housing market? I'm a little bit worried about that, but not ready to call it. So he's not ready to say that we're there yet, but he is concerned. And so something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And I just like to say, I mean, I was covering mortgages and housing in 2006 and 2007. And Robert Shiller was one of the lone voices in the wilderness warning against the housing bubble and everything else. So if he's recommending a cautious approach, I mean, that's something really to think about.
Yeah. He's the one that really researches it in depth, for sure.
And if we're all talking about Robert Shiller, actually, before he won the Nobel Prize, he was identified as an up-and-coming economist on the Goldstein on Gelt show, where I interviewed him before he won the prize. So I like to think that the Nobel Prize Committee was actually looking at my show to decide who to give the prize to. He wasn't the only one, just so you know.
Right. And speaking of looking at things, perhaps it is time to once again look at the Buzz Index.
What do you mean, Miranda?
Well, the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds. So now these are at your fingertips. Now, here is how it works. First of all, the Buzz targets the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the Buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish scores are included in the index. Each month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and then the 75 companies with the most bullish scores are selected, positioning the Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of the crowds. Head over to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and for more information. And don't forget, Joe Saul-Sehy, our co-host, actually invests in the Buzz Index. He enjoys it. He thinks it's been great for his portfolio. That doesn't mean it's right for you. So make sure you do your research, but head on over to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ.
You know, one of the things I like about having our weekly panel discussions is how so often we are able to talk about ideas that we may or may not agree on and really share different ideas and give different proposals. But what I find as a financial planner when families come in is it doesn't always happen that way. And I was sitting today with the brother and sister who had inherited a portfolio of real estate from their parents. And the brother who had been dealing with this up till now had said, you know something, I just don't want to be involved anymore because I think that money issues are what really tears families apart. And Miranda, when you were saying earlier about the idea of someone suggested, well, why don't you buy a property and rent it out to your siblings? I was thinking, really, is this a good idea? What if they don't pay rent? What would you do? And I think this guy was right on that people really have to be very, very hesitant about going into business together or if you inherit a property together, keeping it together. And of course, this happens a lot when siblings inherit a property. I'm kind of bringing together everything we spoke about today, but I see this a lot. You know, siblings will inherit a property, you know, and maybe some of them say, well, why don't we rent it out and collect the rent? And others say, well, you know, why don't we just sell it and we'll all take the money? How do you deal with that? How do you bring the family together to make a decision is really very difficult. And what can complicate it and make it even worse is if the parents had some really strict idea, like, we think you should hold on to this property forever because property is fantastic and we made a lot of money and you all will make a lot of money too. Just stick together. And then you have the children, you know, who may only be, you know, 2, 3, or 4 kids or something. And ultimately the grandchildren who could be dozens of people, all partners in a property that they don't want to be partners in, and they can't really sell it once it gets down to the grandchild level, because who in his right mind would want to buy a 1/20th share of a property where all of the other partners are family? So this is the type of problem I think that a lot of people have when they're dealing with an inheritance that comes in the form of a property. Does this affect, Linda, the way you think about investing in property?
Well, it doesn't affect the way I think about investing in property because I'm just making an investment myself. But I have seen and have been in a situation where I inherited property when my mother passed away with my siblings and did go through that whole process. It was interesting. We decided to sell one property to one sibling, and it was an apartment building, and we didn't really want to be landlords, but she did. So it worked out well for everyone.
How did you come up with the price?
We had to do it at an arm's length. So we hired an expert to appraise the property. We actually listed the property. We actually got offers on the property higher than the listing price. And then my sibling met the highest offer that we got. So it was a very fair process. And we all got full value that way. And we were all, it actually wasn't planned that way. Okay. She actually, we didn't, you know, mean to put everyone through all that work for nothing. But in the end, when the final price came in, she said, wait a minute, I think I want to buy it. And so that is just how it worked out. But it was a very, you know, third party transaction kind of situation. So because we had offers, we felt we were really getting the full market value for it. So I would say they definitely have to go outside the family to get appraisals and keep it very fair for all the siblings so that everyone feels that they got a fair deal. That's really important.
Miranda, do you think it's a good idea for siblings and close family members to get involved in a business together, whether it is perhaps real estate, which they get together, or, you know, a lot of times you see restaurants or small businesses are owned by families? How do you think that really works in terms of just working so close with someone with whom you are so close?
Well, I mean, I think it really depends on your dynamic and what you've done ahead of time to kind of lay the groundwork. I mean, in a lot of cases, you know, it works out okay. I mean, we've seen it, you know, we've seen some of these family businesses, they work fine and it's great. But the problem you run into is what if you have different expectations? And there was a case, actually, one of my friends, you know, her husband and his brother went into business and they had a restaurant and it was great. But it turns out that one of the brothers was hiding information. He was hiding information about the debts from the business. He wasn't very good with the money. And then pretty soon they were like, well, you're not going to get paid. And there's this whole thing. And finally the business failed. And then they looked at the books and realized that, you know, this brother had been hiding so much and they had just trusted him because he was their brother. And so I think, you know, as much as you'd like to trust your family members, you need to have transparency and you need to make sure everybody's on the same page and you need to make sure that there are protections in place for everyone and that everybody has access to the financials. Everybody should be able to see what's going on. And you can't just make excuses because they're your sibling. I mean, a business is a business.
Right. I think in order to do that the right way, also, you really need to bring in outside experts to run portions of the business. Like you need the accountants, you need the lawyers, that, you know, someone else who's really just being paid to watch out that everything is done on the up and up, and not even necessarily that there's some sort of malicious intent on the side of one of the siblings, but maybe one of them is just not really into business or just simply incompetent. And, you know, you don't want a family to fall apart as a result of one person not being as good in business as the other. And one of the things, Linda, I like that, you know, you said worked out in your family was it's okay to buy out the siblings instead of having them as partners forever. Because if someone in the family wants to own the property or the business, to me, that sounds reasonable. But, you know, to force everyone to stay together, as sometimes you see a parent might do in his will or just in a letter, or he just sort of suggests to the kids, don't ever give this up. That's a huge mistake. Don't tell that to the next generation. The next generation, hopefully you've trained them to know how to manage money and be responsible, and they'll have to make their own decisions, you know, as mature adults.
I like what you were saying. You know, you kind of touched on passing it down or the next generation, because the next thing you've got to figure out is what's going to be your legacy plan. How are you going to pass this business on to the next generation? How are you going to divide up ownership? Because, you know, maybe there's two of you, right? There's, you know, two of you are doing this business, but then each of you have two kids. So now there's four people. How are you going to divide up ownership amongst those four people? You know, how many of them really want to be involved? How do you provide them with some of the profits of the business when they leave, as opposed to keeping with the business? So all of that planning has to go into it. And I think that, you know, you make a good point, Doug. You really need to have somebody who is an outsider come in who is an expert at succession planning, who can help you figure all that out.
All right. Thanks, Miranda. Hey, I see we're just about out of time. But in the last few seconds, let's just see what everyone is up to. Linda, what's going on in your world?
Well, we were talking about real estate, and I just did a whole podcast more in depth about what we chatted about today. So check it out at lyndapjones.com/podcasts.
And Miranda?
Just head on over to plantingmoneyseeds.com. We're just ramping up a resource of some investing, some starting investing. I've had a lot of people ask me, like, where can I go to start investing? And I have some different reviews on the website, but no real resource page. So I'm putting together a resource page. So head on over to plantingmoneyseeds.com for a great resource page of where you can go to different places where you can go to start investing. What about you, Doug? What's happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, based on the topic that we really touched on a lot today about inheriting, I just want to mention that my new book, The Inheritance Book, just came out a few weeks ago, which really talks about what everyone should know about receiving and investing in inheritance. It's a little bit kind of a niche market because it's meant for Americans or people who live outside the United States who are getting money in the United States. But if you are one of the many Money Tree Investment Podcast listeners who does, in fact, live outside the United States, this book might be for you. That's The Inheritance Book. You can find out about it at my corporate website at profile-financial.com at the book section.
Very cool. And remember, you can always head over to moneytreepodcast.com to listen to archives of our episodes, learn more about the panelists, learn more about our sponsor, the Buzz Index, and also get more information on resources and tools you can use to grow your own money. Don't forget to subscribe to us. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. When you subscribe every single week, you'll get a fresh new episode delivered to the device of your choice and for your listening pleasure. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.